on and we'll never have to think about it anymore, okay? But still she said nothing. I wanted to go out for an hour's walk and find her cheery when I got back, but I knew there was no chance of that happening. I'd have to solve this one myself. Look, you're tired, I said. Take a little rest and we'll go out for a pizza. When's the last time we had pizza? Anchovies and onions. We'll split one. It wouldn't kill us to eat out once in a while. This didn't do it either. She kept her face pressed against her arms. I didn't know what else to say. I sat down and stared at her across the table. One ear showed through her short black hair. It had an earring that I had never seen before, a little gold one in the shape of a fish. Where could she have bought such a thing? I wanted a smoke. I imagined myself taking my cigarettes and lighter from my pocket, putting a cigarette between my lips and lighting up. I inhaled a lungful of air. The heavy smell of stir-fried beef and vegetables struck me hard. I was starving. My eye caught the calendar on the wall. This calendar showed the phases of the moon. The full moon was approaching. Of course, it was about time for Kumiko's period. Only after I became a married man did it truly dawn on me that I was an inhabitant of Earth, the third planet of the solar system. I lived on the Earth revolved around the sun, and around the Earth revolved the moon. Like it or not, this would continue for eternity, or what could be regarded as eternity in comparison with my lifetime. What induced me to see things this way was the absolute precision of my wife's 29-day menstrual cycle. It corresponded perfectly with the waxing and waning of the moon, and her periods were always difficult. She would become unstable, depressed even, for days before they began. So her cycle became my cycle. I had to be careful not to cause any unnecessary trouble at the wrong time of the month. Before we were married, I hardly noticed the phases of the moon. I might catch sight of the moon in the sky, but its shape at any given time was of no concern to me. Now the shape of the moon was something I always carried around in my head. I'd been with a number of women before Kumiko, and of course each had had her own period. Some were difficult, some were easy, some were finished in 3 days, others took over a week, some were regular, others could be 10 days late and scare the hell out of me. Some women had bad moods, others were barely affected. Until I married Kumiko, though, I had never lived with a woman. Until then, the cycles of nature meant the changing of the seasons. In winter, I'd get my coat out. In summer, it was time for sandals. With marriage, I took on not only a cohabitant, but a new concept of cyclicity, the phases of the moon. Only once had she missed her cycle for some months, during which time she had been pregnant.
"I'm sorry,"
she said, raising her face.
"I didn't mean to take it out on you. I'm tired and I'm in a bad mood."
"That's okay," I said. "Don't let it bother you. You should take it out on somebody when you're tired. It makes you feel better." Kumiko took a long, slow breath, held it in a while, and let it out.
"What about you?"
she asked. "What about me?"
"You don't take it out on anybody when you're tired." "I do. Why is that?"
I shook my head. "I've never noticed," I said. "Funny."
"Maybe you've got this deep well inside and you shout into it, 'The king's got donkey's ears,' and then everything's okay."
I thought about that for a while. "Maybe," I said. Kumiko looked at the empty beer bottle again. She stared at the label, and then at the mouth, and then she turned the neck in her fingers.
"My period's coming," she said. "I think that's why I'm in such a bad mood."
"I know," I said. "Don't let it bother you. You're not the only one. Loads of horses die when the moon's full." She took her hand from the bottle, opened her mouth, and looked at me.
"Now, where did that come from all of a sudden? I read it in the paper the other day. I meant to tell you about it, but I forgot. It was in an interview with a vet. Apparently, horses are tremendously influenced by the phases of the moon, both physically and emotionally. Their brainwaves go wild as the full moon approaches, and they start having all kinds of physical problems. Then, on the night itself, a lot of them get sick, and a huge number die. Nobody really knows why this happens, but the statistics prove that it does. Horse vets never have time to sleep on full moon nights. They're so busy.
Interesting, said Kumiko.
An eclipse of the sun is even worse, though. Nothing short of a tragedy for horses. You can't begin to imagine how many horses die on the day of a total eclipse. Anyhow, all I want to say is that right this second, horses are dying all over the world. Compared with that, it's no big deal if you take out your frustrations on somebody. So don't let it bother you. Think about the horses dying. Think about them lying on the straw in some barn under the full moon, foaming at the mouth, gasping in agony.
She seemed to take a moment to think about horses dying in barns.
Well, I have to admit, she said with a note of resignation, you could sell anybody anything.
All right, then, I said. Change your clothes and let's go out for a pizza. That night, in our darkened bedroom, I lay beside Kumiko, staring at the ceiling and asking myself just how much I really knew about this woman. The clock said 2 a.m. She was sound asleep. In the dark, I thought about blue tissues and patterned toilet paper and beef and green peppers. I had lived with her all this time, unaware how much she hated these things. In themselves, they were trivial, stupid, something to laugh off, not make a big issue out of. We'd had a little tiff and would have forgotten about it in a couple of days, but this was different. It was bothering me in a strange new way, digging at me like a little fishbone caught in the throat. Maybe, just maybe, it was more crucial than it had seemed. Maybe this was it, the fatal blow, or maybe it was just the beginning of what would be the fatal blow. I might be standing at the threshold of something big, and inside lay a world that belonged to Kumiko alone, a vast world that I had never known. I saw it as a big, dark room. I was standing there holding a cigarette lighter, its tiny flame showing me only the smallest part of the room. Would I ever see the rest, or would I grow old and die without ever really knowing her? If that was all that lay in store for me, then what was the point of this married life I was leading? What was the point of my life at all if I was spending it in bed with an unknown companion? This was what I thought about that night, and what I went on thinking about long afterwards from time to time. Only much later did it occur to me that I had found my way to the core of the problem.
3. Maltacano's Hat. Sherbet Tone and Allen Ginsberg and the Crusaders. I was in the middle of preparing lunch when the phone rang again. I had cut 2 slices of bread, spread them with butter and mustard, filled them with slices of tomato and cheese, set the whole on the chopping board, and I was just about to cut it in half when the bell started ringing. I let the phone ring 3 times and cut the sandwich in half. Then I transferred it to a plate, wiped the knife, and put that in the cutlery drawer before pouring myself a cup of the coffee I had warmed up. Still, the phone went on ringing, maybe 15 times. I gave up and answered it. I would have preferred not to answer, but it might have been Kumiko.
"Hello," said a woman's voice, one I had never heard before. It belonged neither to Kumiko nor to the strange woman who had called me the other day when I was cooking spaghetti. "I wonder if I might possibly be speaking with Mr. Toru Okada?" said the voice, as if its owner were reading a prepared text.
"You are," I said.
"The husband of Kumiko Okada?"
"That's right," I said. "Kumiko Okada is my wife."
"And Mrs. Okada's elder brother is Noboru Wataya?"
"Right again," I said with admirable self-control.
"Noboru Wataya is my wife's elder brother." "Sir, my name is Kano."
I waited for her to go on. The sudden mention of Kumiko's elder brother had put me on my guard. With the blunt end of the pencil that lay by the phone, I scratched the back of my neck. 5 seconds or more went by, during which the woman said nothing. No sound of any kind came from the receiver, as if the woman had covered the mouthpiece with her hand and was talking to someone nearby.
"Hello?"
I said, concerned now.
"Please forgive me, sir," blurted the woman's voice. "In that case, I must ask your permission to call you at a later time."
"Now, wait a minute," I said. "This is..."
At that point, she rang off. I stared at the receiver, then put it to my ear again. No doubt about it. The woman had hung up. Vaguely dissatisfied, I turned to the kitchen table, drank my coffee, and ate my sandwich. Until the moment the telephone rang, I'd been thinking of something, but now I couldn't remember what it was. Knife in my right hand, poised to cut the sandwich in half, I had definitely been thinking of something. Something important. Something I had been trying unsuccessfully to recall for the longest time. It had come to me at the very moment when I was about to cut the sandwich in two, but now it was gone. Chewing on my sandwich, I tried hard to bring it back, but it wouldn't come. It had returned to that dark region of my mind where it had been living until that moment. I finished eating and was clearing the dishes when the phone rang again. This time I took it right away. Again I heard a woman saying, "Hello," but this time it was Kumiko.
"How are you?" she asked. "Finished lunch?"
"Yep. What did you have?"
"Nothing," she said. "Too busy. I'll probably buy myself a sandwich later. What did you have?"
I described my sandwich.
"I see,"
she said, without a hint of envy.
"Oh, by the way, I forgot to tell you this morning, you're going to get a call from a Miss Kano."
"She already called," I said, "a few minutes ago. All she did was mention our names, mine and yours and your brother's, and hang up. Didn't say what she wanted. What was that all about?"
"She hung up?"
"Said she'd call again."
"Well, when she does, I want you to do whatever she asks. This is really important. I think you'll have to go and see her."
"When, today?"
"What's wrong? Do you have something planned? Are you supposed to be seeing someone?"
"Nope. No plans. Not yesterday, not today, not tomorrow. No plans at all." "But who is this Kano woman, and what does she want with me? I'd like to have some idea before she calls again. If it's about a job for me connected with your brother, forget it. I don't want to have anything to do with him. You know that."
"No, it has nothing to do with a job,"
she said with a hint of annoyance.
"It's about the cat."
"The cat?"
"Sorry, I've got to run. Somebody's waiting for me. I really shouldn't have taken the time to call. Like I said, I haven't even had lunch. I'll get back to you as soon as I'm free."
"Look, I know how busy you are, but give me a break. I want to know what's going on. What's with the cat? Is this Kano woman..."
"Just do what she tells you, will you please? Understand? This is serious. I want you to stay at home and wait for her call. Must go."
And she went. When the phone rang at 2:30, I was napping on the couch. At first I thought it was the alarm clock. I reached out to push the button, but the clock was not there. I wasn't in bed, but on the couch, and it wasn't morning, but afternoon. I got up and went to the phone.
"Hello," I said.
"Hello,"
said a woman's voice. It was the woman who had called in the morning.
"Mr. Toru Okada?"
"That's me, Toru Okada."
"Sir, my name is Kano," she said.
"The lady who called before."
"That is correct. I'm afraid I was terribly rude, but tell me, Mr. Okada, would you by any chance be free this afternoon?"
"You might say that."
"Well, in that case, I know this is terribly sudden, but do you think it might be possible for us to meet?"
"When? Today? Now?"
"Yes."
I looked at my watch. Not that I had to. I'd looked at it 30 seconds earlier, but just to make sure. And it was still 2:30.
"Will it take long?" I asked.
"Not so very long, I think. I could be wrong, though. Just at this moment, it is difficult for me to say with complete accuracy. I am sorry."
No matter how long it might take, I had no choice. Kumiko had told me to do as the woman said.
that it was serious. If she said it was serious, then it was serious, and I had better do as I was told.
I see, I said. Where should we meet?
Would you by any chance be acquainted with the Pacific Hotel across from Shinagawa Station?
I would.
There is a tea room on the first floor. I shall be waiting there for you at 4 o'clock, if that would be all right with you, sir.
Fine, I said.
I am 31 years old, and I shall be wearing a red vinyl hat.
Terrific. There was something weird about the way this woman talked, something that confused me for a moment. But I could not have said exactly what made it so weird, nor was there any law against a 31-year-old woman wearing a red vinyl hat.
I see, I said. I'm sure I'll find you.
I wonder, Mr. Okada, if you would be so kind as to tell me of any external distinguishing characteristics of your own.
I tried to think of any external distinguishing characteristics I might have. Did I have any?
I'm 30, I'm 5'9", 10 stone, short hair, no glasses.
It occurred to me as I listed these that they hardly constituted external distinguishing characteristics. There could be 50 such men in the Pacific Hotel tea room. I'd been there before, and it was a big place. She needed something more distinctive. But I couldn't think of anything. Which is not to say that I didn't have any distinguishing characteristics. I owned a signed copy of Miles Davis's Sketches of Spain. I had a slow resting pulse rate, 47 normally, and no higher than 70 with a high fever. I was out of work. I knew the names of all the brothers Karamazov. But none of these characteristics was external.
"What might you be wearing?"
she asked.
"I don't know," I said. "I haven't decided yet. This is so sudden."
"Then please wear a polka-dot tie,"
she said decisively.
"Do you think you might have a polka-dot tie, sir?"
"I think I do," I said. I had a navy blue tie with tiny cream polka dots. Kumiko had given it to me for my birthday a few years earlier.
"Please be so kind as to wear it, then," she said. "Thank you for agreeing to meet me at 4 o'clock.
And she hung up. I opened the wardrobe and looked for my polka-dot tie. There was no sign of it on the tie rack. I looked in all the drawers, I looked in all the storage boxes in the wardrobe. No polka-dot tie. There was no way that tie could be in our house without my finding it. Kumiko was such a perfectionist when it came to the arrangement of our clothes. My tie couldn't possibly be in a place other than where it was normally kept. And in fact, I found everything, both her clothes and mine, in perfect order. My shirts were neatly folded in the drawer where they belonged. My sweaters were in boxes so full of mothballs, my eyes hurt just from opening the lid. One box contained the clothing she had worn at school. A navy uniform, a flowered mini-dress preserved like photos in an old album. What was the point of keeping such things? Perhaps she'd simply brought them with her because she hadn't found a suitable opportunity to get rid of them. Or maybe she was planning to send them to Bangladesh or donate them one day as cultural artifacts. Anyway, my polka-dot tie was nowhere to be found. Hand on the wardrobe door, I tried to recall the last time I had worn the tie. It was a rather stylish tie, in very good taste, but a bit too much for the office. If I had worn it to the firm, somebody would have gone on and on about it at lunch, praising the color or its sharp looks, which would have been a kind of warning. In the firm I worked for, it was not good to be complimented on your choice of tie, so I had never worn it there. Rather, I put it on for more private, if somewhat formal, occasions, a concert or dinner at a good restaurant, when Kumiko wanted us to dress properly, not that there were so many such occasions. The tie went well with my navy suit, and she was very fond of it. Still, I couldn't recall when I had last worn it. I scanned the contents of the wardrobe again and gave up. For one reason or another, the polka-dot tie had disappeared. Oh, well, I put on my navy suit with a blue shirt and a striped tie. I wasn't too worried. She might not be able to spot me, but all I had to do was look for a 30-ish woman in a red vinyl hat. Dressed to go out, I sat on the sofa, staring at the wall. It had been a long time since I last wore a suit. In normal circumstances, this 3-season navy suit would have been a bit too heavy for this time of year, but that particular day was a rainy one, and there was a chill in the air. It was the very suit I had worn on my last day of work, in April.
Suddenly, it occurred to me that there might be something in one of the pockets. In the inside breast pocket, I found a receipt with a date from last autumn. It was some kind of taxi receipt, one I could have been reimbursed for at the office. Now, though, it was too late. I crumpled it up and threw it into the wastebasket. I had not worn this suit once since resigning, 2 months earlier. Now, after such a long interval, I felt as if I were in the grip of a foreign substance. It was heavy and stiff, and seemed not to match the contours of my body. I stood and walked around the room, stopping in front of the mirror to yank at the sleeves and the coattails in an attempt to make it fit better. I stretched out my arms, took a deep breath, and bent forward at the waist, checking to see if my physical shape might have changed in the past 2 months. I sat on the sofa again, but still I felt uncomfortable. Until this spring, I had commuted to work every day in a suit without its ever feeling strange. My firm had had a rather strict dress code, requiring even low-ranking clerks such as myself to wear suits. I had thought nothing of it. Now, however, just sitting on the couch in a suit felt like an immoral act, like faking one's curriculum vitae or dressing as a woman. Overcome with something very like a guilty conscience, I found it more and more difficult to breathe. I went to the front hall, took my brown shoes from their place on the shelf, and squeezed myself into them with a shoehorn. A thin film of dust clung to them. As it turned out, I didn't have to find the woman. She found me. When I arrived at the tea room, I did a quick circuit, looking for the red hat. There were no women with red hats. My watch showed 4:10. I took a seat, drank the water they brought me, and ordered a cup of coffee. No sooner had the waitress left my table than I heard a woman behind me saying, "You must be Mr. Toru Okada." Surprised, I spun around. Not 3 minutes had gone by since my survey of the room. Under a white jacket, she wore a yellow silk blouse, and on her head was a red vinyl hat. By reflex, I stood and faced her. Beautiful was a word that might well have been applied to her. At least she was far more beautiful than I had imagined from her telephone voice. She had a slim, lovely build, and was sparing in her use of makeup. She knew how to dress, except for the red hat. Her jacket and blouse were finely tailored. On the collar of the jacket shone a gold brooch in the shape of a feather. She could have been taken for a corporate secretary. Why, after having lavished such care on the rest of her outfit, she would have topped it off with that inappropriate red vinyl hat was beyond me. Maybe she always wore it to help people spot her in situations like this. In that case, it was not a bad idea. If the point was to have her stand out in a room full of strangers, it certainly did the job. She took the seat across the table from mine, and I sat down again. "I'm amazed you knew it was me," I said. "I couldn't find my polka dot tie. I know I've got it somewhere, but it just wouldn't turn up, which is why I wore this striped one. I thought I'd find you, but how did you know it was me?"
"Of course I knew it was you,"
she said, putting her white patent leather bag on the table. She took off her red vinyl hat and placed it over the bag, covering it from view. I had the feeling she was about to perform a magic trick. When she lifted the hat, the bag would have vanished.
"But I was wearing the wrong tie,"
I protested.
"The wrong tie?"
She glanced at my tie with a puzzled expression, as if to say, "What is this odd person talking about?" Then she nodded.
"It doesn't matter. Please don't be concerned."
There was something strange about her eyes. They had a mysterious lack of depth. They were lovely eyes, but they did not seem to be looking at anything. They were all surface, like glass eyes. But of course they were not glass eyes. They moved and their lids blinked. How had she been able to pick me out of the crowd in this busy tea room? Virtually every chair in the place was taken, and many of them were occupied by men my age. I wanted to ask her for an explanation, but I restrained myself. Better not raise irrelevant issues. She called to a passing waiter and asked for a Perrier. They had no Perrier, he said, but he could bring her tonic water.
She thought about this for a moment and accepted his suggestion. While she waited for her tonic water to arrive, she said nothing, and I did the same. At one point, she lifted her red hat and opened the clasp of the pocketbook underneath. From the bag, she removed a glossy black leather case, somewhat smaller than a cassette tape. It was a business card holder. Like the bag, it had a clasp, the first card holder I had ever seen with a clasp. She drew a card from the case and handed it to me. I reached into my breast pocket for one of my own cards, only then realizing that I did not have any with me. Her name card was made of thin plastic, and it seemed to carry a light fragrance of incense. When I brought it closer to my nose, the smell grew more distinct. No doubt about it, it was incense. The card bore a single line of small black letters. Malta Cano. Malta. I turned the card over. It was blank. While I sat there wondering about the meaning of this name card, the waiter came and placed an ice-filled glass in front of her, then filled it halfway with tonic water. The glass had a wedge of lemon in it. The waitress came with a silver-colored coffee pot on her tray. She placed a cup in front of me and filled it with coffee. With the furtive movements of someone slipping an unlucky shrine fortune into someone else's hand, she eased the bill onto the table and left.
"It's blank,"
Malticano said to me. I was still staring at the back of her name card.
"Just my name. There is no need for me to include my address or telephone number. No one ever calls me. I am the one who makes the calls."
"I see," I said. This meaningless response hovered in the air above the table like the floating island in Gulliver's Travels. Holding her glass with both hands, she took one tiny sip through a straw. The hint of a frown crossed her face, after which she thrust the glass aside as if she had lost all interest in it.
"Malta is not my real name," said Malta Cano. "The Cano is real, but the Malta is a professional name I took from the island of Malta. Have you ever been to Malta, Mr. Okada?"
I said I had not. I had never been to Malta, and I had no plans to go to Malta in the near future. It had never even crossed my mind to go there. All I knew about Malta was the Herb Alpert performance of The Sands of Malta, an authentic stinker of a song.
"I once lived in Malta," she said, "for 3 years. The water there is terrible, undrinkable, like diluted seawater, and the bread there is salty. Not because they put salt in it, but because the water they make it with is salty. The bread is not bad, though. I rather like Malta's bread."
I nodded and sipped my coffee.
"As bad as it tastes, the water from one particular place on Malta has a wonderful influence on the body's elements. It is very special, even mystical water, and it is available only in one place on the island. The spring is in the mountains, and you have to climb several hours from a village at the base to get there. The water cannot be transported from the spring. If it is taken elsewhere, it loses its power. The only way you can drink it is to go there yourself. It is mentioned in documents from the time of the Crusades. They call it spirit water. Allen Ginsberg once came there to drink it. So did Keith Richards. I lived there for 3 years, in the little village at the foot of the mountain. I grew vegetables and learned to weave. I climbed to the spring every day and drank the special water, from 1976 to 1979. Once, for a whole week, I drank only that water and ate no food. You must not put anything but that water in your mouth for an entire week. This is a kind of discipline that is required there. I believe it can be called a religious austerity. In this way, you purify your body. For me, it was a truly wonderful experience. This is how I came to choose the name Malta when I returned to Japan."
"May I ask what your profession is?" She shook her head.
"It is not my profession, properly speaking. I do not take money for what I do. I am a consultant. I talk with people about the elements of the body. I am also engaged in research on water that has beneficial effects on the elements of the body. Making money is not a problem for me. I have whatever assets I need. My father is a doctor, and he has placed stocks and shares in a trust for my younger sister and myself. An accountant manages them for us. They produce a decent income each year. I have also written several books that bring in a little income. My work on the elements of the body is an entirely non-profit-making activity, which is why my card bears neither address nor telephone number. I am the one who makes the calls.
I nodded, but this was simply a physical movement of the head. I had no idea what she was talking about. I could understand the words she spoke, but it was impossible for me to grasp their overall meaning. Elements of the body? Allen Ginsberg? I became increasingly uneasy. I'm not one of those people with special intuitive gifts, but the more time I spent with this woman, the more I seemed to smell trouble. "You'll have to pardon me," I said, "but I wonder if I could ask you to explain things from the beginning, step by step. I talked to my wife a little while ago, and all she said was that I should see you and talk to you about our missing cat. To be quite honest, I don't really see the point of what you've just been telling me. Does it have anything to do with the cat?"
"Yes, indeed," she said. "But before I go into that, there is something I would like you to know, Mr. Okada."
She opened the metal clasp of her pocketbook again and took out a white envelope. In the envelope was a photograph, which she handed to me.
"My sister," she said.
It was a color snapshot of two women. One was Malta Kano, and in the photo, too, she was wearing a hat, a yellow knit hat. Again, there was an ominous mismatch with her outfit. Her sister, I assumed this was the younger sister whom she had mentioned, wore a pastel-colored suit and matching hat of the kind that had been popular in the early 60s. I seem to recall that such colors had been known as sherbet tone back then. One thing was certain, however. These sisters were fond of hats. The hairstyle of the younger one was precisely that of Jacqueline Kennedy in her White House days, loaded with hairspray. She wore a little too much makeup, but she could nonetheless be described as beautiful. She was in her early to mid-20s. I handed the photo back to Malta Kano, who returned it to its envelope and the envelope to the handbag, shutting the clasp.
"My sister is 5 years my junior," she said. "She was defiled by Noboru Wataya, violently raped."
Terrific. I wanted to get the hell out of there, but I couldn't just stand up and walk away. I took a handkerchief from my jacket pocket, wiped my mouth with it, and returned it to the same pocket. Then I cleared my throat. "That's terrible," I said. "I don't know anything about this, but if he did hurt your sister, you have my heartfelt condolences. I must tell you, however, that my brother-in-law and I have virtually nothing to do with each other. So if you're expecting some kind of..."
"Not at all, Mr. Okada," she declared. "I do not hold you responsible in any way. If there is someone who should be held responsible for what happened, that person is myself. For being inattentive. For not having protected her as I should have. Unfortunately, certain events made it impossible for me to do so. These things can happen, Mr. Okada. As you know, we live in a violent and chaotic world. And within this world, there are places that are still more violent, still more chaotic. Do you understand what I mean, Mr. Okada? What has happened has happened. My sister will recover from her injuries, from her defilement. She must. Thank goodness they were not fatal. As I have said to my sister, the potential was there for something much, much worse to happen. What I am most concerned about is the elements of her body."
"Elements of her body?" I repeated. This elements of the body business was obviously a consistent theme of hers.
"I cannot explain to you in detail how all these circumstances are related. It would be a very long and complicated story, and although I mean no disrespect to you when I say this, it would be virtually impossible for you at this stage, Mr. Okada, to attain an accurate understanding of the true meaning of that story, which involves a world that we deal with on a professional basis. I did not invite you here in order to voice any complaint in that regard. You are, of course, in no way responsible for what has happened. I simply wanted you to know that, although it may be a temporary condition, my sister's elements have been defiled by Mr. Wataya. You and she are likely to have some form of contact with each other sometime in the future. She is my assistant, as I mentioned earlier. At such time, it would be best for you to be aware of what occurred between her and Mr. Wataya, and to realize that these things can happen.
A short silence followed. Multicano looked at me as if to say, "Please think about what I have told you." And so I did, about Noboru Wataya's having raped Multicano's sister, about the relationship between that and the elements of the body, and about the relationship between those and the disappearance of our cat. "Do I understand you to be saying," I ventured, "that neither you nor your sister intends to bring a formal complaint on this matter? To go to the police?"
"No, of course we will do no such thing," said Multicano, her face expressionless. "Properly speaking, we do not hold anyone responsible. We would simply like to have a more precise idea of what caused such a thing to happen. Until we solve this question, there is a real possibility that something even worse could occur."
I felt relief on hearing this. Not that it would have bothered me in the least if Noboru Wataya had been convicted of rape and sent to prison. It couldn't happen to a nicer guy. But Kumiko's brother was a rather well-known figure. His arrest and trial would be certain to make the headlines, and that would be a terrible shock for Kumiko, if only for my own mental well-being, I preferred the whole thing to go away.
"Rest assured," said Multicano. "I asked to see you today purely about the missing cat. That was the matter about which Mr. Wataya sought my advice. Mrs. Okada consulted him on the matter, and he in turn consulted me."
That explained a lot. Multicano was some kind of clairvoyant or a medium, and they had consulted her on the whereabouts of the cat. The Wataya family was into this kind of stuff, divination and house physiognomy and such. That was fine with me. People were free to believe anything they liked, but why did he have to go and rape the younger sister of his spiritual counselor? Why stir up a lot of pointless trouble? "Is that your area of expertise?" I asked. "Helping people find things?" She stared at me with those depthless eyes of hers, eyes that looked as if they were staring into the window of a vacant house. Judging from their expression, she had failed to grasp the meaning of my question. Without answering, she said,
"You live in a very strange place, don't you, Mr. Okada?"
"I do," I said. "Strange in what way?" Instead of replying, she pushed her almost untouched glass of tonic water another 6 or 8 inches away from herself.
"Cats are very sensitive creatures, you know."
Another silence descended on the two of us. "So our place is strange, and cats are sensitive animals," I said. "Okay, but we've lived there a long time, the two of us and the cat. Why now, all of a sudden, did it decide to leave us? Why didn't it leave before?"
"That I cannot tell you. Perhaps the flow has changed. Perhaps something has obstructed the flow."
"The flow?"
"I do not know yet whether your cat is still alive, but I can be certain of one thing. It is no longer in the vicinity of your house. You will never find the cat in that neighborhood."
I lifted my cup and took a sip of my now lukewarm coffee. Beyond the tea room windows, a misty rain was falling. The sky was covered over with dark, low-hanging clouds, a sad, procession of people and umbrellas climbed up and down the footbridge outside.
"Give me your hand," she said.
I placed my right hand on the table, palm up, assuming she was planning to read my palm. Instead, she stretched her hand out and put her palm against mine. Then she closed her eyes, remaining utterly still, as if silently rebuking a faithless lover. The waitress came and refilled my cup, pretending not to notice what Multicano and I were doing. People at neighboring tables stole glances in her direction. I kept hoping all the while that there were no acquaintances of mine in the vicinity.
"I want you to picture to yourself one thing you saw before you came here today," said Multicano.
"One thing?" I asked.
"Just one thing."
I thought of the flowered mini-dress that I had seen in Kumiko's clothes storage box. Why that of all things happened to pop into my mind, I have no idea. It just did. We kept our hands together like that for another 5 minutes. 5 minutes that felt very long to me. Not so much because I was being stared at by people, as that the touch of Multicano's hand had something unsettling about it. It was a small hand, neither hot nor cold. It had neither the intimate touch of a lover's hand nor the functional touch of a doctor's. It had the same effect on me as her eyes had, turning me into a vacant house. I felt empty. No furniture, no curtains, no rugs, just an empty container. Eventually, Multicano withdrew her hand from mine and took several deep breaths. Then she nodded several times.
"Mr. Okada," she said, "I believe that you are entering a phase of your life in which many different things will occur. The disappearance of your cat is only the beginning."
"Different things?" I said. "Good things or bad things?" She tilted her head in thought.
"Good things and bad things. Bad things that seem good at first, and good things that seem bad at first."
"That sounds very general," I said. "Don't you have any more concrete information?"
"Yes, I suppose what I am saying does sound unspecific," said Multicano. "But after all, Mr. Okada, when one is speaking of the essence of things, it often happens that one can only speak in generalities. Concrete things capture one's attention, but they are often little more than trivia, sideshows. The more one tries to see into the distance, the more generalized things become."
I nodded silently, without the slightest inkling of what she was talking about.
"Do I have your permission to call you again?" she asked.
"Sure," I said, though in fact I had no wish to be called by anyone. "Sure" was about the only answer I could give. She snatched her red vinyl hat from the table, took the handbag that had been hidden beneath it, and stood up. Uncertain as to how I should respond, I remained seated.
"I do have one small bit of information that I can share with you," Multicano said, looking down at me after she had put on her red hat. "You will find your polka dot tie, but not in your house."
4. High towers and deep wells, or far from Nomonhan. Back at home, I found Kumiko in a good mood. A very good mood. It was almost 6 o'clock by the time I arrived home after seeing Multicano, which meant I had no time to fix a proper dinner. Instead, I prepared a simple meal from what I found in the freezer, and we each had a beer. She talked about work, as she always did when she was in a good mood, whom she had seen at the office, what she had done, which of her colleagues had talent and which did not, that kind of thing. I listened, making suitable responses. I heard no more than half of what she was saying, not that I disliked listening to her talk about these things. Contents of the conversation aside, I loved watching her at the dinner table as she talked with enthusiasm about her work. This, I told myself, was home. We were doing a proper job of carrying out the responsibilities that we had been assigned to perform at home. She was talking about her work, and I, after having prepared dinner, was listening to her talk. This was very different from the image of home that I had imagined before marriage. But this was the home I had chosen. I had had a home, of course, when I was a child, but it was not one I had chosen for myself. I had been born into it, presented with it as an established fact. Now, however, I lived in a world that I had chosen through an act of will. It was my home. It might not be perfect, but the fundamental stance I adopted with regard to my home was to accept it, problems and all, because it was something I myself had chosen. If it had problems, these were almost certainly problems that had originated within me. "So what about the cat?" she asked. I summarized for her my meeting with Multicano in the hotel in Shinagawa. I told her about my polka dot tie, that there had been no sign of it in the wardrobe, that Multicano had nonetheless managed to find me in the crowded tea room, that she had a unique way of dressing and of speaking, which I described. Kumiko enjoyed hearing about Multicano's red vinyl hat, but when I was unable to provide a clear answer regarding the whereabouts of our lost cat, she was deeply disappointed.
"Then she doesn't know where the cat is either?"
Kumiko demanded.
"The best she could do was tell you it is no longer in our neighborhood?"
"That's about it," I said. I decided not to mention anything about the obstructed flow of the place we lived in, or that this could have a connection with the disappearance of the cat. I knew it would bother Kumiko, and for my own part, I had no desire to increase the number of things we had to worry about. We would have had a real problem if Kumiko insisted on moving because this was a bad place. Given our present economic situation, it would have been impossible for us to move. "That's what she tells me," I said. "The cat is not around here anymore."
"Which means it will never come home?"
"I don't know," I said. She was vague about everything. All she came up with were hints. She did say she'd get in touch with me when she found out more, though.
"Do you believe her?"
"Who knows? I don't know anything about this kind of stuff." I poured myself some more beer and watched the head settle. Kumiko rested her elbow on the table, chin in hand.
"She must have told you she won't accept payment or gifts of any kind," she said.
"Uh-huh. That's certainly a plus," I said. "So what's the problem? She won't take our money. She won't steal our souls. She won't snatch the princess away. We've got nothing to lose."
"I want you to understand one thing," said Kumiko. "That cat is very important to me. Or should I say to us? We found it the week after we got married, together, you remember?"
"Of course I do."
"It was so tiny, and soaking wet in the pouring rain. I went to meet you at the station with an umbrella, poor little baby. We saw him on the way home. Somebody'd thrown him into a beer crate next to the off-license. He's my very first cat. He's important to me, a kind of symbol. I can't lose him."
"Don't worry, I know that."
"So where is he? He's been missing for 10 days now. That's why I called my brother. I thought he might know a medium or clairvoyant, somebody who could find a missing cat. I know you don't like to ask my brother for anything, but he's followed in my father's footsteps. He knows a lot about these things."
"Ah, yes. The Wataya family tradition," I said, as cool as an evening breeze across an inlet. "But what's the connection between Noboru Wataya and this woman?" Kumiko shrugged.
"I'm sure she's just somebody he happened to meet. He seems to have so many contacts these days."
"I'll bet."
"He says she possesses amazing powers, but that she's pretty strange."
Kumiko poked at her macaroni casserole.
"What was her name again?"
"Multicano," I said. "She practiced some kind of religious austerities on Malta."
"That's it, Multicano. What did you think of her?"
"Hard to say." I looked at my hands resting on the table. "At least she wasn't boring. And that's a good thing. I mean, the world's full of things we can't explain, and somebody's got to fill that vacuum. Better to have somebody who isn't boring than somebody who is, right? Like Mr. Honda, for example."
Kumiko laughed out loud at the mention of Mr. Honda.
He was a wonderful old man, don't you think? I liked him a lot.
Me too, I said.
For about a year after we were married, Kumiko and I used to visit the home of old Mr. Honda once a month. A practitioner of spirit possession, he was one of the Wataya family's favorite medium types. But he was terrifically hard of hearing. Even with his hearing aid, he could only just make out what we said to him. We had to shout so loud, our voices would rattle the shoji paper. I used to wonder if he could hear what the spirit said to him if he was so hard of hearing, but perhaps it worked the other way. The worse your ears, the better you could hear the words of the spirits. He had lost his hearing in the war. A non-commissioned officer with Japan's Manchurian garrison, the Kwantung Army, he had suffered burst eardrums when an artillery shell or a hand grenade or something exploded nearby during a battle with a combined Soviet Outer Mongolian unit at Nomonhan on the border between Outer Mongolia and Manchuria. Our visits to Mr. Honda's place were not prompted by a belief in his spiritual powers. I'd never been interested in such things, and Kumiko placed far less trust in supernatural matters than either her parents or her brother. She did have a touch of superstition, and she could be upset by an ominous prognostication, but she never went out of her way to involve herself in spiritual affairs. The only reason we went to see Mr. Honda was because her father ordered us to. It was the one condition he set for us to marry. True, it was a rather bizarre condition, but we went along with it to avoid complications. Neither of us had expected an easy time from her family. Her father was a government official, the younger son of a not very well-to-do farm family in Niigata. He had attended the prestigious Tokyo University on a scholarship, graduated with honors, and become an elite member of the Ministry of Transport. This was all very admirable, but as is so often the case with men who have made it like this, he was arrogant and self-righteous. Accustomed to giving orders, he harbored not the slightest doubt concerning the values of the world to which he belonged. For him, hierarchy was everything. He bowed to superior authority without question, and he trampled those beneath him without hesitation. Neither Kumiko nor I believed that a man like that would accept a poor 24-year-old nobody like me, without position or pedigree, decent grades or future promise, as a marriage partner for his daughter. We thought that after her parents turned us down, we'd get married on our own and have nothing to do with them. Still, I did the right thing. I observed form and went to ask Kumiko's parents for her hand in marriage. To say that their reception was cool would be an understatement. The doors of all the world's refrigerators seemed to have been thrown open at once. That they gave us their permission in the end, with reluctance, but in a near miraculous turn of events, was thanks entirely to Mr. Honda. He asked them everything they had learned about me, and in the end, he declared that if their daughter was going to get married, I was the best possible partner for her, that if she wanted to marry me, they could only invite terrible consequences by opposing the match. Kumiko's parents had absolute faith in Mr. Honda at the time, and so there was nothing for it but to accept me as their daughter's husband. I was always the outsider, though, the uninvited guest. Kumiko and I would visit their home and have dinner with them twice a month with mechanical regularity. This was a truly loathsome experience, situated at the precise midpoint between meaningless mortification of the flesh and brutal torture. Throughout the meal, I had the sense that their dining room table was as long as a railway station. They would be eating and talking about something way down at the other end, and I was too far away for them to see. This went on for a year, until Kumiko's father and I had a violent argument, after which we never saw each other again. The relief this gave me bordered on ecstasy. Nothing so consumes a person as meaningless exertion. For a time after our marriage, though, I did exert myself to maintain good relations between us. And without a doubt, the least painful of my exertions were those monthly meetings with Mr. Honda. All payments to Mr. Honda were made by Kumiko's father. We merely had to visit Mr. Honda's home in Meguro once a month with a big bottle of sake, listen to what he had to tell us, and go home.
Simple.
We took to Mr. Honda straight away. He was a nice old man, whose face would light up whenever he saw the sake we had brought him. We liked everything about him, except perhaps the way he left his television on full blast because he was so hard of hearing. We always went to his house in the morning. Winter and summer he sat with his legs in the sunken hearth. In winter he would have a quilt wrapped around his waist to hold in the heat of the charcoal fire. In summer he used neither quilt nor fire. He was apparently a rather famous fortune-teller, but he lived very simply, ascetically even. His house was small, with a tiny entrance hall barely big enough for one person at a time to tie or untie a pair of shoes. The tatami mats on his floors were badly worn, and cracked window panes were patched with tape. Across the way stood a garage where someone was always yelling at the top of his lungs. Mr. Honda wore a kimono that was a cross between a sleeping robe and a traditional workman's jacket. It gave no evidence of having been washed in the recent past. He lived alone and had a woman come in to do the cooking and cleaning. For some reason, though, he never let her launder his robe. Scraggly white whiskers hung on his sunken cheeks. If there was anything in Mr. Honda's house that could be called impressive, it was the huge color television set. In such a tiny house, its gigantic presence was overwhelming. It was always tuned to the government-supported NHK network. Whether this was because he loved NHK, or he couldn't be bothered to change the channel, or this was a special set that received only NHK, I had no way of telling, but NHK was all he ever watched. Instead of a flower arrangement or a calligraphic scroll, the living room's ceremonial alcove was filled with this huge television set, and Mr. Honda always sat facing it, stirring the divining sticks on the table above his sunken hearth while NHK continued to blast out cooking shows, bonsai care instructions, news updates, and political discussions.
"Legal work might be the wrong thing for you, son,"
said Mr. Honda one day, either to me or to someone standing 20 yards behind me.
"It might?"
"Yes, it might. The law presides over things of this world in the end. The world where shadow is shadow and light is light, yin is yin and yang is yang. I'm me and he's him. I am me and he is him, Artem Eve. But you don't belong to that world, son. The world you belong to is above that or below that."
"Which is better?" I asked out of simple curiosity. "Above or below?"
"It's not that either. What is better?"
he said. After a brief coughing fit, he spat a glob of phlegm onto a tissue and studied it closely before crumpling the tissue and throwing it into a wastebasket.
"It's not a question of better or worse. The point is not to resist the flow. You go up when you're supposed to go up, and down when you're supposed to go down. When you're supposed to go up, find the highest tower and climb to the top. When you're supposed to go down, find the deepest well and go down to the bottom. When there's no flow, stay still. If you resist the flow, everything dries up. If everything dries up, the world is darkness. I am he, and he is me. Spring, nightfall. Abandon the self, and there you are."
"Is this one of those times when there's no flow?"
Kumiko asked.
"How's that?"
"Is this one of those times when there's no flow?"
Kumiko shouted.
"No flow now,"
Mr. Honda said, nodding to himself.
Now's the time to stay still. Don't do anything. Just be careful of water. Sometime in the future, this young fellow could experience real suffering in connection with water. Water that's missing from where it's supposed to be. Water that's present where it's not supposed to be. In any case, be very, very careful of water.
Kumiko, beside me, was nodding with the utmost gravity, but I could see she was struggling not to laugh.